This is Macro Analytics, delivering frank conversations on global macroeconomics and market analysis outside the mainstream, featuring discussions and debates between Gordon T. Long, publisher and editor of GordonTLong.com, and his guests. The content of this discussion is strictly the opinion of the participants. It is in no way a solicitation for business, nor is it to be considered investment advice of any sort. Always consult a registered investment advisor before making any investment decision. These discussions are extremely hard-hitting and terribly frank, and parental discretion is advised. Now, on to the show.
Good morning. I'm Gord Long with GordonTLong.com. As part of our ongoing series on financial repression, I have James Turk joining us this morning from London. James is a very well-recognized authority in the international banking, financial, and investment arena. He is known for being the founder and managing director of Gold Money, which just recently merged with Bitgold. So welcome, James.
Thanks, Gordon. It's great to be with you.
I've been looking forward to talking to you for a while, so I'm really pleased that you joined us. I'm certainly very familiar with your background, but could you just give our listeners who may not be some of the things that you've been involved with in your career?
Yeah, I've been involved in banking back in the 1970s. I worked in Abu Dhabi managing the commodity portfolio for that country's sovereign wealth fund, the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority. And then in the late 1990s, I founded with my oldest son, Gold Money. And Gold Money has turned out to be a very successful way for because of providing a convenient, economical, and safe way for people to buy and sell physical precious metals and store that metal in several different vaults in different countries around the world. We're presently storing about $1.25 billion of customer assets. The other thing I've done is I've co-authored a couple of books. The most recent one with my friend John Rubino is entitled The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops.
And we have that book featured on our website regularly because John is a co-host with me on our Macro Analytics series. So we've covered the book. So for those that haven't, lots of information on James's latest book. James, we're here to talk about amongst three different subjects, but the first is financial repression. And I would really like you if you could share with our listeners what that terminology means to you, concerns you may have with it, and where do you see it leading to?
Yeah, when you talk about financial repression, my immediate reaction is government intervention. Government intervention in the market process. And this is always something that distorts the signals that are important as entrepreneurs invest capital, as individuals save capital. By distorting these signals, you get false impressions as to what you should be doing, you know, in terms of how you place your money. So, you know, government intervention in the markets is not only distorting, it's counterproductive. Because typically, you know, governments don't like what the market is saying, but the reason the market might be saying something is because of government policy in the first place. Rather than change the policy, they try to make the markets believe that the policy the governments and the politicians are pursuing is the correct one, but in fact it's not. And if we look at here in Europe as an example, you know, from 1950 up until 1999, the Deutsche Mark, which was managed by the German Bundesbank, that country's central bank, essentially maintained its purchasing power over that period of time. It was almost as good as gold. You know, today an ounce of gold buys the same amount of crude oil it did back in 1950. In 1999, a Deutsche Mark almost bought the same amount of gold, same amount of crude oil as it did back in 1950. It wasn't quite as good as gold, but it was very, very good. But since 1999, the euro has followed a path similar to the US dollar, the British pound, and all of the other fiat currencies that are pursuing policies that are basically not sustainable. And it's an interesting point that you're raising because back in 2009, when the Greece crisis was first appearing, I wrote an article called "Will the Greece Crisis Bring the End of our Sovereign Debt Defaults Bring the End of Socialism?" Because it gets down to the point that there's only so much wealth being created in the world, and that wealth can be, you know, distributed, but eventually that wealth has to come from somewhere if it's going to be distributed in a meaningful way. What governments are trying to do here in Europe and in most countries around the world through their financial repression is they make believe that they're creating wealth by printing currency and distributing that currency in their various different programs. That's not creating wealth, that's just debasing the currency. And when you debase the currency, that's perhaps the worst type of financial repression, because you're essentially destroying the ability of people to interact voluntarily with one another in the marketplace as we fulfill our needs and wants. So we're going through a process, I think, Gordon, where governments are eventually going to come to understand, hopefully, that government intervention is counterproductive, and we have to go back to the way things used to be, that governments were outside of the market process. What governments are there for is to maintain the rule of law and a level playing field. Governments distort that level playing field for themselves and for their favorite interests to the disadvantage of the mass of people.
I really see your point in terms of distortions, the amount of mispricing of risk, the lack of price discovery, the amount of malinvestment that starts to spin out of that, and your comment about wealth and therefore wealth preservation. The capitalist system is about savings being reinvested into productive assets. And what we have now is that wealth is not being created at a fast enough rate, so we have creditism. That is, we're producing credit for the sake of consumption. That's not wealth. And where it breaks down in a number of ways, James, my view is that you can't have more and more debt without collateral. You need collateral. Everybody wants to lend money, but they need it posted. And we're not creating enough wealth. Matter of fact, in some cases, we're destroying it, that it's underpinning our ability to continue to grow debt and credit because there's insufficient collateral. And therefore, what eventually happens is you get insufficient liquidity out there when it starts to erode, non-performing, et cetera. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I agree with you completely. I express it slightly differently. When you look at wealth, it essentially comes in two different forms. It comes in tangible assets, you know, things like real estate, oil wells, buildings, farmland, timberland. And then you also have financial wealth. Financial wealth is fundamentally different because it's not a tangible asset. It's nothing physical. And more to the point, financial wealth depends on someone's IOU or someone's promise. So you have counterparty risk with financial wealth. And if you look at monetary history, we go through these periods of crises where the financial wealth is destroyed because promises are not fulfilled. There's just not enough wealth to be able to cash flow being generated to fulfill the promises. And with the consequence of that, the financial assets get destroyed, but the real wealth is going to still be there. This is something I actually learned from my parents from the Great Depression. You know, at the end of the day, they said, you know, the land was still there, the factories were still there, the houses were still there, but a lot of financial wealth was destroyed. And I think we saw a little bit of that in 2008, but the real crisis is still coming. It's a crisis where we're finally going to realize that this path that we're on, that governments are on, is not sustainable because, as you say, there's not enough wealth or cash flow being generated to service all of these promises out there. Now, they sustained it to a certain extent with financial repression by bringing interest rates down to zero or even negative in some cases. But that's totally against the capitalist system that enables capital to be used productively to grow depending on the risks one's taking in exchange for the return that should be generated over a period of time. So what's happening when you have artificially low interest rates like this, lower than the rates of inflation, you're destroying capital, and as in a macro sense, the world is becoming less wealthy.
Yeah, destroying capital. Wealth to me, you know, I'm in the old school, you either got to grow it, you got to mine it, or you got to build it. That's the real essence of the wealth, and everything else are claims on that. Mm-hmm. And then you get into counterparty risk, et cetera, on the IOUs or the IOUs on it. We're seeing all sorts of examples of what you're saying. In China, in this week, the things that they're going through to stabilize the market, which is total manipulation to the right off the end of the scale. But in Greece, the kinds of things that are going on in Greece and the threatening of bail-ins, that is, you know, that we're seeing ATMs used as weapons in many ways where they're shutting them down, limiting the amount of cash, and now all of a sudden if the banks get into trouble seizing, as we did in Cyprus, but much lower levels. James, I'd really appreciate your views on this whole concept of bail-ins and the war on cash that we're seeing and whether they tie together.
Yeah, they do tie together because, you know, cash you can transact with outside the banking system. And banks don't like that. Governments don't like that. There's this unholy alliance these days where banks and governments work together to try to sustain and perpetuate the welfare state. And they try to do this in a way that will be mutually beneficial to the two of them, but not necessarily to the mass of the people. And in order to perpetuate these welfare states, they'll do whatever they need to do. Cyprus is a good example. You know, they took the depositors in the money of depositors in the banks. In Greece, it looks like they're going to do the same thing, take the money of depositors in the banks. That's why you can't really trust the banking system anymore. You know, I learned banking back in the late 1960s from guys that had lived and worked through the Great Depression. And they had an entirely different perspective as to what banking was versus what banking is today. You know, banking today is not banking in a historical or traditional sense. Banking today is really a hedge fund. And what we need to do is go back to basics. This is something that actually John and I discuss in our book, The Money Bubble. You know, the problem with banking today is that banks have two different functions. They have a lending function where they lend money to people, obviously. And they also have a payment function where you put your money on deposit in a bank, and that deposit circulates as deposit currency in commerce, you know, by checks, plastic cards, wire transfers, or whatever. These two functions in banking are incompatible. We have to go back to the way banks used to be. You used to have banks of credit, which made loans, and then you had banks of commerce, which were responsible solely for payments but didn't actually lend any money, so that depositor money was never at risk. That's what we need to do. We need to separate banks back the way they used to be and quit. No longer allow banks to operate as hedge funds as they presently do. If they want to make risk-making loans, if shareholders want to do that in a bank for credit, but don't allow that bank to be involved in the payments business. Don't allow that bank to take depositor money just because a bank got into trouble with a government approval to take depositor money. Because ultimately, this is destroying the capitalist system. And the problem with this, of course, Gordon, is this capitalist system, where, you know, people are interacting voluntarily with one another to improve their situation. You know, Adam Smith's invisible hand. This is what enabled humankind to raise standards of living, you know, consistently, you know, decade after decade after decade, or century after century. And when you destroy that market process, you're destroying the ability to raise our standards of living, and ultimately everybody suffers.
These concerns, and there's a couple hour discussion here on banking in general and how that whole migration happened and exposures within it. But is it the fear of really banks not being safe? Is that going to push cryptocurrencies, Bitgold, Bitcoin, etc., potentially start to explode in the future?
Yeah, I think so. You know, gold and silver have been around for 5,000 years. They have a proven history. They were chosen by the market as money because of the attributes and features that they have. Those attributes and features have not been destroyed. They've not been lost. They've only been ignored or forgotten. And we're in what John and I called the money bubble. You know, what we're using today in commerce is not really money. It's a money substitute circulating in place of money. Money comes into circulation the same way all other goods and services come into circulation, like you were saying, by production. You have to work to create, mine gold out of the ground, and that gold then serves as a form of money. It's just like any other real wealth is being created. So what my expectation is that this aberration that we've been in since 1971, when the dollar's formal link to gold was broken, is really just that, an aberration. We're seeing the problems by moving off in a tangent in this direction, moving away from sound money. And eventually we're going to have a collapse. We're going to recognize the folly of our ways and go back to a sound money system, which is what, incidentally, the Constitution in the United States provided. One of the reasons to creating a more perfect union was because of the collapse of the Continental, you know, the country's first currency. And what the framers of the Constitution did is they created a common market with a common currency called the U.S. dollar, which was a specific weight of silver at the time. So this is what we need to go back to. We need to go back to the wisdom of the framers. We need to go back and look at the lessons of monetary history and recognize that we're on a path that's unsustainable. Now, governments and politicians are probably never going to recognize that, or at least most of them won't. So what we as individuals have to do recognizing that the future is uncertain and unpredictable, we have to prepare for it the best way we can. And one of the logical ways to do that is to look at what has a proven history and track record. And gold and silver have been around for 5,000 years. The odds are they're going to be around for the foreseeable future, if not another 5,000 years. And all we really want to do is be prepared for the foreseeable future in the best possible way. So we have to own physical gold and physical silver as part of a well-balanced portfolio.
Well, a big part of the world still believes very strongly in gold and silver as a form of money. And I'm thinking of Russia, I'm thinking of China, I'm thinking of most of the BRICS who are into the acquisition or acquiring gold reserves versus the developed countries who are selling them. So therein begs a lot of questions. But all these problems begin, James, as you said, when you lose the discipline of sound money.
Yes.
And then all these become symptoms of that initial stage. And to return to it is almost an impossibility without some form of crisis, in my opinion. But we'll see on that one.
It can be done logically if the politicians have the will to make it happen and the leadership has the vision to make it happen. It happened in the United States with the creation of the Constitution. All we have to go back to is what the Constitution required and recognize that the dollar as it exists today is an unconstitutional form of currency. It also happened back after the war between the states when the greenbacks were created. There was a period when, again, a financial turmoil, and the government decided that, okay, we have to go back to gold, and we're going to do it in 10 years. So they had a 10-year plan to resume back to constitutional money. We could create another 10-year plan if we wanted to. There's going to be a lot of pain going that direction, but a lot less pain by planning for it than by just letting a financial collapse to inevitably happen, which is the way politicians are moving at the moment.
I never ceases to be amazed at how brilliant and strong our leaders, founding fathers, were and visionary and demonstrating real leadership. I mean, they had it right. And I guess it's because at that time some of these problems were blatantly obvious that they were trying to bridge from. And now we've got lulled and we lose perspective. I'd like to get us back to, James, if we could, one of the most important things I wanted to talk to you about is the merger of gold money with BitGold. What prompted that, and where do you see it? Where do you see the future in the merger?
Yeah, we're really quite excited about it because we're bringing together two companies that have the same vision but have different strengths. And so we're combining the strengths of the two companies to achieve that vision. And basically what we're talking about is the digital gold currency that BitGold makes available is very, very complementary to the savings and way of accumulating gold and silver through gold money itself. So we think it's a very powerful combination, and I'm quite excited about the future. Since the transaction was announced, BitGold's shares on the Toronto Venture Exchange have done very well. So I think the market is also responding to the potential that the combined companies offer. I have a high degree of confidence in the BitGold management team. From top to bottom, they are really first-class people. And combined with the first-class people we already have in gold money, I think we have a powerful combination. BitGold will continue to operate separately from gold money, which will continue to operate over here in Europe. But the two will become more closely interlinked over time to the advantage of customers of both companies, as well as to the shareholders of BitGold itself. Which, by the way, when we finally close, which is hopefully going to be within a few days now, the attorneys are still crossing the T's and dotting the final I's. The name of BitGold will be changed to Gold Money Group Incorporated.
Gold Money Group, okay. Up until recently, BitGold wasn't available to Americans, but I believe that has now changed here in the last month or so.
Yes, they can open accounts, but they can't use the spending mechanism that BitGold has available. There's still some uncertainty with regard to rules and regulations in the United States about spending or using as currency, digital gold currency. So as long as you don't live in the United States, you can use BitGold from a point of view of spending digital gold currency. If you live in the United States, you can't spend digital gold currency, but you can open an account and begin accumulating metal through BitGold, as well as through gold money, for that matter.
A Financial Repression Authority is an affiliate of gold money, or BitGold, rather. So I need to mention that, and the information on that is available throughout our website. James, we're running up against our hard time. There's so much to talk about here, but are there any clear messages you'd like to leave with our listeners on these subjects?
Yeah, I think we're at the early stages of another 2008 financial collapse. Remember, we talked about the financial collapse in 2008 when Lehman went under in September of that year. But there were a lot of signs ahead of time. There was a lot of writing on the wall. Did it start when Bear Stearns collapsed earlier that year? Did it collapse the year before when Northern Rock here in the UK collapsed? Or did it even collapse before that when two Bear Stearns hedge funds invested in real estate went under? I think what's happening in Greece, what happened in Cyprus, these are indications that we're heading for another 2008 crisis. Whether it's going to happen this year or next year, I don't know. But I do know that the best way to prepare for it is to own tangible assets of all sorts, tangible assets that make sense, and minimize your exposure to counterparty risk whenever you can. And as far as liquidity and money are concerned, the best way to prepare for an uncertain future is to own physical gold and physical silver.
Well said, absolutely. James, could you tell our listeners how they could follow, learn more about your work and the things you're involved with and your writings? Because I believe you're still writing, right?
Yeah, occasionally. I'm getting a little bit older, so I don't write as much as I used to. And I used to have a website where I was writing regularly. I don't really contribute to that anymore, but all of the old articles are still there. Some of them are quite useful and interesting, even though they were written years ago. You know, they've survived the passage of time. But you can find me at goldmoney.com. And the latest book that John Rubino and I have written is The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops, which I think provides a good perspective on the present situation and how to prepare for the future.
James, thank you very much for your time this morning. We're going to have you back here to explode a number of these subjects. One of them I want to talk to you about is China and spend time on that. But that's all we have time for here today. So all the best, and we'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Gordon. I'd love to be back.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Gordon T. Long, editor and publisher of GordonTLong.com. New recordings are posted regularly and can be found at GordonTLong.com. New show notifications are available through RSS feed, iTunes, and other social networking venues at GordonTLong.com.